Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. He has worn many hats in his long career in the Houston restaurant business. He has been on the marketing side. He has been on the operations side. He has been in an industry support role. And now he is a commercial real estate broker. Jonathan Horowitz, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, Eric. Thank you for having me. And always nice to see you.
Thanks for doing this. You know, I want to talk about restaurant real estate with you, but just can we do like 2 minutes? Last time you were here, you were the president of the Houston Hospitality Alliance. You left that role last year. I don't expect you to say anything negative about the Houston Hospitality Alliance. And indeed, if nothing else, you ran a contest to which I won a $500 gift card to March. So I will always be appreciative of both you and the Houston Hospitality Alliance for funding, well, honestly, about half of a really nice dinner at March for two.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I hope it was as enjoyable as it always should be over there.
It was outstanding. And my friend hadn't been there before. And
oh, nice. That's always fun to be able to show somebody something new and something special like that.
Yeah. So can we just say, is there like a 2 minute, mostly positive explanation for why you're no longer affiliated with the Houston Hospitality Alliance?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, with regard to that contest, that was, you know, really the idea behind that was to celebrate, you know, the whole Michelin star system coming to Houston, been a long time talked about, and everybody was anticipating it. And, you know, we wanted to do something that would not only celebrate the fact that we were getting the Michelin guide coming into Houston, but then also support, you know, some of the local restaurants that were either being considered or being awarded, and et cetera. And in fact, I think you and Willett Feng won some of the.
Yeah, Willett won the grand prize. Willett won like four or five gift cards. Willett and Diane feasted on the Houston Hospitality Alliance's dime.
Yeah, they were also very appreciative. Obviously, the former owners, I guess now, of Burger Chan, and they certainly enjoyed that as well. So. Yeah, that the organization, you know, is still going on, obviously, and it's out there with the other organizations that support the hospitality industry in Houston, Texas Restaurant Association, Hotel and Lodging Association, Houston First to some extent as well. So they're, you know, continuing that mission. I think our goals may have diverged this year with some changes in leadership, which is totally fine and understandable. So, you know, I hope that they and all of the other organizations, whatever they might be, for-profit, nonprofit, whatever they are, that are out there supporting the hospitality industry writ large in Houston, they need all the support that they can get. The industry needs all the support it can get. And, you know, certainly wish all of them well. That includes, you know, the Southern Smokes, and I'll have what she's having, and all of those other ones that provide so much support to the industry. It's indispensable at this point, because as we all know, it's tough out there in the industry. It's always been tough, and it's getting tougher.
It is. And then, as I sort of alluded to, I mean, you were the president of the hospitality group that owned Ninfa's and Antone's. You were in a marketing role for the company behind the Tasting Room when they were at their peak. How did you find your way to commercial real estate as your current opportunity?
Yeah, so it's been a long and winding road. You know, it's interesting. I was telling the story to somebody the other day. I started my professional career as an attorney, right? That was back in, God, 1998 or so. And I practiced law for about 6 years. And then in early 2005, I became one of the owners and partners in the Tasting Room, and then later, you know, Max's Wine Dive as we expanded that. And I did that for a span of 10 years. That was 2005 to 2015. Then I spent another 5 years as CEO of the company that owns as you said, Original Ninfas and Antone's Po' Boys. So that was a big 15-year stretch, and that was my sort of entree into the hospitality industry, which is, you know, a whole nother story in terms of how I kind of grew up as the hospitality industry in Houston was really kind of exploding with national recognition and incredible growth and diversity and all that, which has been fantastic and really amazing to be a part of. And that took us literally right up until about 6 weeks before the pandemic hit. And on February 1st of 2020, I decided to leave that role with Legacy Restaurants and launch my hospitality consulting company. Brilliant stroke of timing. And about six right. weeks later, literally 6 weeks later, March 18th, the world shut down, as we all know. And so after a span of 15 years of doing just two different jobs, in the past 5 years, I've had about what seems like 20. I've done all kinds of different things, had the hospitality company that I'm still doing, Convive Hospitality, which has given me the opportunity to work with all kinds of different folks and great clients and various things. I was with Colliers Real Estate for a little while, then Midway Development, which did City Center and is doing East River. And I ran the brewery for a little while, Buffalo Bayou, before.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about it. Right. I was really rooting for the Midway thing because you were going to be the person who brought Din Tai Fung to Houston.
I would love that. I'm a huge Din Tai Fung fan, as many people are. But over the course of all of that time, getting back to your original question, I was always kind of tangentially involved in the real estate side of things. And having the legal background obviously helped. And so I was always kind of doing that sort of on the side, maybe unofficially. And then when the shutdown happened in the early days of the pandemic, I still have my law license. It's inactive, but I still have it. And then I went and got my real estate license because I was associated with Colliers. And I figured, you know, nobody's doing anything right now. I might as well go spend some time and get the real estate license. So I did that. And I've focused on that kind of off and on over the past 5 years. After I left HHA this spring, I really kind of delved back into it. And it's interesting, and I'm sure we'll talk more about, you know, the industry today, but one of the reasons I joined up with the real estate group that I did, which is a Restaurant Realty Group out of San Antonio, is they focus a lot on the business transaction side of restaurants, where people are looking to buy and sell, as opposed to just the leasing of restaurant space, either for the landlord or for the tenant.
Right, right. So this is, someone's got an existing concept, and for whatever reason, they don't want to keep operating it.
Exactly.
And they're looking for someone to take it over.
Exactly. So, you know, there's, and what I kind of foresaw at the last year, the beginning of this year, et cetera, is that there was likely going to be a lot more transactional activity with people looking to sell and subsequently, you know, people looking to purchase restaurants. And that has certainly borne out to be true in that there are a lot more inquiries to the business about selling restaurants right now as there are leasing them, as you would imagine.
Right. And I mean, intuitively, I think people who listen to the show probably understand why. It's that it's never been more expensive or harder, I guess, to operate a restaurant with everything from the cost of ingredients to the cost of real estate to the cost of labor. And so whatever, you know, if you got in the business, you know, say pre-pandemic, you know, like 2017 or 2018, you're operating in a very different world now than you were back then.
Entirely. Everything has changed. And we can talk more about that as well. I mean, and we've touched on this, I think, in the past. You know, the pandemic was just an absolute watershed for the industry, completely changed operations and technology and customer expectations and just the way people interact with food and restaurants. I mean, it completely changed. But the prevailing element of all of that is it's just gotten so much more expensive, as you said. And now This year, it's gotten even more expensive when you factor in inflationary issues and uncertainty in the market and consumers tending to pull back a little bit, people drinking less, all of those things are combining to make it an extraordinarily challenging environment for restaurants, more so than in the past. It's never been easy, but now it's even harder. I've said to folks a lot lately that there's probably been no more challenging of a time to be trying to run a restaurant than going back to like the Great Depression, right? Obviously, I didn't live through those times, but I can't imagine any more difficult time in our lifetimes that it's been to run a restaurant.
Well, and in the very early days of like the shutdown phase of the pandemic, there were all of these people nationally predicting, half of all restaurants were going to close and this, that, and the other thing. And of course, we did see some closures in those early days, but nothing like what we expected for a variety of reasons, right? There were sort of government programs that intervened and really helped people out. And then in Texas, we didn't stay shut down for that long, right?
Right.
Like the period of not being able to dine in restaurants only lasted, I don't know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it was. It was, relative to our peers like in New York and California that stayed closed for a year or more,
Completely different.
we had
Completely
a
different.
very different experience.
Yeah, and if you look, if you take the last 5 years collectively, frankly, there's no better place to be doing business in the hospitality industry than in Texas. As tough as it is now, as difficult as it is, with all of the challenges and the costs and everything, everybody in the industry here should be really happy we're here and not somewhere else, because it has become so much more difficult.
All right, so I mean, it's tricky to sort of speak about specific use cases, but when we see when we see like an announcement that Pico's is closing, and Arnaldo Richards says as part of the media outreach to kind of get the word out that his business has dropped 18% year over year, when you hear something like that, what do you think kind of contributes to that? Like, what why? Because it seems very sudden, right? It seems very abrupt. This restaurant that's been around for 40 years is closing. Like, what has caused this like sudden change in demand?
So I think as is the case with the business overall, I don't think it's one specific thing. I don't think that there is one singular factor that you can point to. And I would say in the case of, for example, Pico's and Arnaldo, I am sure, and I don't know 100%. He hasn't told me, but I would imagine, business didn't all of a sudden just drop 18% this year. I'm sure it has been somewhat of a decline over time. And I will tell you that I have heard, I talk to people all of the time who are operating in the Houston market, and that those kind of numbers are not unusual right now this year. People have told me about, all just the entire revenue stream has changed. So I think when you're looking for causes, I think the first place you look is consumer behavior. And particularly this year, and we kind of forget that we've only had kind of, the new administration's been in office for what, 6, 7 months now, or a very short relative period of time, and we've had some
Right. I mean,
disruption.
it's September 22nd, so almost exactly 9 months, right? Like January
Yeah.
20th to September 22nd.
Right. So it feels like it's been a heck of a lot longer, but some of the regulatory stuff and the economic stuff that we've been experiencing since the spring is relatively new. And I have seen that it has really changed a lot of consumer behavior. People are trading down, they're not spending as much, they're not going out as much. And I was literally just reading last night some of the Nation's Restaurant News stuff about the changes in behavior for folks in the country with incomes less than $100,000, household incomes less than $100,000. And that segment of the consumer market has pulled back even more. Right now, higher wage earners and households with much higher incomes are sustaining the higher end of the restaurant industry, but the lower end is really feeling it. So the people with money are still going out and doing their thing and they're eating. The folks with less discretionary income are pulling back even more right now. And you look at I was talking to somebody just yesterday about a slowdown in consumer traffic that they are attributing to some immigration policies and people's, some populations' fears of just going out in public. So that is impacting some of the consumer behavior. So you've got a lot of these economic factors, a lot of societal factors right now. We saw just last month the reports coming out about the lowest percentage of Americans drinking alcohol since the 70s, right? And that has absolutely impacted the revenue on restaurants and bars that rely on higher margin cocktail sales to sustain their businesses. Like, everything about the revenue model for restaurants has changed, particularly in the past year or so.
Yeah, I think this is kind of what we talk about, right? Like the kind of the fast casual places that are at a lower price point seem to be doing okay or even growing. The fine dining places seem to be doing just fine. And it's the places in the middle that are getting squeezed. Pico's is part of that. Riel is part of that. Ostia is part of that.
Riel.
Riel's a heartbreaker.
I pour one out for Riel all the time right now. I mean, I can talk a little bit more about consumer behavior, but I use Quinn and I as an example of this. And I'll tell you a brief story about a conversation I had with Chef David Cordua, which was eye-opening for me. But we are, we're empty nesters now and we're kind of homebodies. And the circle of restaurants, the area that of restaurants that we frequent is like a mile and a half, right? We live kind of on the edge of West U. We're kind of near Greenway Plaza, et cetera. And I think about all these places in the Heights, that we just don't go to. I mean, the Heights might as well be freaking Dallas at this point because we don't go.
Yeah, no, this is my theory that nobody crosses the bayou.
Yeah.
Right? Heights people don't come south into Montrose.
Right.
And Montrose, River Oaks, West U people like don't go north. And that's why like Blue Dorn and Navy Blue are not very far from each other,
right,
in terms of their geography. But there is very little overlap in their customer bases, from what I understand, because that's
sure.
Like two different worlds. They like functionally, they might as well be two different.
Yeah. And I think about how much I love, for example, like Squabble, right? And or Cultivare. Forgive me, Ryan Parra, but I haven't been there in 10 years. I mean, literally. And it's phenomenal. It's literally one of the best restaurants in the city. It's been around, what, pushing 20 years or something like that?
2014, I think. 12 years. 11 or 12 years.
Oh, boy. It feels like longer. Okay. But I can tell you, I know because I remember the last time I was there and who we ate with. It was the end of 2015. It was the last time I was there. And it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, I feel like sort of an obligation to, like, get out a little more.
Yeah, it's kind of your job.
And I talked about this. I talked about this with Bobby Hugel when he was on the show a few weeks ago. Like, I'm making a conscious decision to like revisit some of these old favorites. So like, I've been to Nancy's Hustle in the last couple of months when it had been a while since I had been there. I had dinner at Squabble last week because I was coming from an event and I was going to something else in the Heights, and it's like, let's pop in. And then I also have to like stop myself because I've still. Like, instead of going to Agnes and Sherman or Camaraderie or Basso, right, where I'm always like, I want the shiny new thing always. Like,
yeah.
All right. Let's not like, let me not do that just for today. Let me go support this older restaurant that I haven't been to in a minute. And even sitting in the dining room with my friend, we're like, yeah, I come here for brunch every now and then. But like, when's the last time I had dinner at Squabble? Like, I really couldn't
right.
tell you. And it's still great. Like still one of the best restaurants in Houston. And I, like we could have gone to Cultivare. Like that was the other choice. And they were running a burger special. And so I went to Squabble instead. But like, but like making that conscious choice to revisit these older places is hard, I think, for people, right? Because you do get in a rut you know, it's so easy just as a, you know, you go to the places that are close, that are familiar to you, where they know you, and it's easier.
Well, that's and that's a great segue into the little story that I wanted to tell, because when I was having this conversation with David Cordua, I asked him a question about what their potential expansion plans would be, you know, with Limbar, and did they what did he want to do? And he made the point to me that he said, you know, I've kind of figured it out that we don't want to be a destination kind of spot, you know, going forward. And this speaks to, and I bring this up because I thought it was an incredibly salient point, and it speaks to what restaurants nowadays theoretically should be doing in order to set themselves up for success and potentially, you know, have staying power. And his whole point was, you need to find a spot to open something interesting, cool, different, whatever it is, something, you know, attractive, where you can win the neighborhood. You have to dominate the neighborhood wherever you are. And you look at, you know, places like Squabble Cultivare, you know, Milton's now, Good Company Seafood, for example, off of West Park, right? They dominate the neighborhoods. And his point was, if you, as a restaurateur and an operator, if you can be the default choice for everybody within a mile or two radius, and you know, you're attractive enough, your food is good enough, your service is good enough, and you can accommodate these people and make them happy, you have a really good chance of sticking around and being successful if you can dominate the neighborhood. So his point was, he didn't want to go anywhere where he was going to be competing with five other places that all do the same thing in a very close proximity, or if there isn't a well-defined neighborhood that they can go in and dominate. And I keep thinking about, this was a year ago we had the conversation, but I keep thinking about that because, you know, when I talk to folks about potential locations or a new concept or, you know, where should they go or what should they do, my first thought and the first thing I'll say to them is, can you dominate this neighborhood? Can you be the default choice? And I come back to, you know, I can count on two hands the places that Quinn and I go on the regular. And they are, as I said, within a mile, maybe mile and a half. If we get, you know, if we get crazy, we'll go to Kenny and Ziggy's in the Galleria, or, you know, we'll drive to Midtown to go to Pho Saigon. But other than that, we're almost within walking distance of 8-9 places that we go. And they're all comfortable. They're not expensive, right? You know, they're not super high end, but we love it. And we're just, it is a rare occasion that we're going to drive somewhere for 20, 30, 40 minutes. It's kind of a catch-22 because we don't have to, because Houston has such a bounty of amazing places to go, and there's incredible diversity, and there's so much of it. We're not forced to go drive somewhere to eat.
Well, and even just to sort of emphasize the point, like, you're the kind of person who should be, like, you appreciate a great meal. You, when you travel, you dine very well, and you know the scene well enough to know what's out there. Like, you know how great Belly of the Beast is.
Yeah.
But you're probably not, maybe once a year you'll drive to Spring.
I feel like I got to have my passport renewed just to go.
I make all the Oregon Trail jokes when it's when it's time. It's like, I got to get my hardtack, I got to get my biscuits, I got to make sure I have enough buckshot or Game of Thrones, Beyond the Wall.
Exactly. Think about and I'm wearing, you know, my Fat Eatery. I've got my Alex on today, and you know, I think about Katie Asiatown, right? I mean, there's so many great places out there, and you know, that's hell and gone from where we are.
Right. I want Dim Sum Box to come to me, right? I want Dim Sum Box to come to Midtown because I think it's great, but I'm, you know, 35 or 40 minutes in the car for Dim Sum just feels like a pretty big commitment.
But think about what you just said in terms of, you know, I want this to come to me. The other thing that I failed to mention is that there's probably at least 3 nights a week, maybe 4, that we're having food delivered to us. And when I was talking earlier about, you know, customers and how they've changed and what the expectations are. I mean, the desire for speed and convenience and value, right? Everybody talks about you got to have a great value proposition. Everything has changed. You don't necessarily have to go anywhere anymore. It will come to you. And that has changed so dramatically in the past 5 years in an industry that is notoriously slow to change, right? It's glacial the way things have changed. This has completely changed us in 5 years.
Well, that is certainly true, but that is not like, I feel like that has gotten so expensive. By the time you pay the fee and tip the driver and the prices are marked up relative to the price of like either picking it up yourself or dining in.
Well, that's because the restaurants have to survive. You know, the margins are so thin.
Right. I mean, my Kenny and Ziggy's order of a pastrami sandwich and a potato knish and a slice of cake is like a 60-something dollar Uber Eats delivery by the time it's all said and done, which feels kind of outrageous, but it doesn't stop me.
It's still $52 if you drove over there and ate it in the dining room.
Right, but it would be hotter and fresher and more delicious.
But what's the price to pay for convenience, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about in terms of consumer behavior and how it's changed and what the expectations are. You know, that whole idea of not having to drive and do pickup anymore, you know, that desire for speed and convenience, that has really amplified. And, you know, let's not forget that none of that would be possible. None of this, we wouldn't be talking about this if technology hadn't changed the entire game, right? Think about the advances in restaurant technology in terms of the third-party deliveries and the online ordering and all of that stuff. I mean, there has been a revolutionary shift in such a short amount of time. And frankly, I think the industry is still trying to catch up and its head is still spinning from the COVID years. And the industry just hasn't caught up to the changes brought on by the technology and consumer behavior. And it's going to be a while. And that's why I think we're going to continue to see a lot of closures, you know, neighborhood places, big names, whatever they are. We're not out of the woods yet, unfortunately. And I know we've had this conversation before, and it's been proving true, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, I used to say there's no more annoying like online response to comment. It's like, oh, we have too many burger places. We have too many steakhouses. We have too many Tex-Mex. We have too many, you know. And my response for years was, show me the one that closes, right? And there weren't any. And now you can come back at me, especially in steakhouses, and be like, well, Andiron failed, or, you know, some of these, like, a couple other places come to mind. The Saltillo, you know, closed in Bel Air, right? That concept should have been an absolute no-brainer. The food was delicious. There was nothing like it nearby. It wasn't crazy expensive, and it just, like, I'd go there like once a year for a friend's birthday party. We'd get the giant ribeye cap and we'd be with, you know, three other tables. And so, surprised it didn't last, but I never understood why it wasn't more popular, you know, because I think ultimately, like, as a steakhouse is kind of a destination and people want the pomp and circumstance. And so they're going to, like, they'll drive the extra 10 minutes to go to Pappas Brothers or Steak 48 or whatever it is.
Yeah. I think there's definitely an element of that, but I think you're seeing those decisions are being made less frequently now. I mean, you know, if you have a household that may have done it four times a year in the past, maybe they're only doing it twice a year now. And, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons for that. You know, we talked earlier about some of the reasons that we think this may be happening, but you can add to that list. And part of this was the less drinking, the percentage of people who are drinking less, but just a focus a little bit more on being healthy. You talk about the Ozempic craze and all of that. People are just physically,
they just physically can't eat that much anymore.
Right. They're just eating less. And I know now, I mean, as you mentioned, we reserve a lot of our finer dining and special occasion stuff for when we travel. But even now I notice when the two of us go out, you know, we'll order one entree and split it. You know, we never used to do that. That's right. New for us.
Well, and the reality of all these costs going up, you know, that $18 cocktail or that $22 glass of wine, that's it. Like you can only shear me once for that, right? I'm not, because otherwise you wind up, you know, you could spend $150 on food and another $100 on alcohol for two people. And it's, you just feel you knew what you were doing. The prices were on the menu. You knew what you were doing when you ordered it, but like it's painful and it makes you less likely to go back.
Right. That's all about that value proposition, right? You know, we talk about people wanting that better value. It's tough, but you can't, I don't think anybody necessarily is, but you can't blame the restaurants, right? Because they're dealing with the higher rent and the higher insurance and the higher food input costs. And think about how expensive, you know, good protein is and labor expenses that have gone up and all of those other inputs. It is what it is. And we talk about how the restaurant industry as a whole has had to adapt. Now, on the flip side, the consumer is having to adapt, right? You know, it's like, oh, this burger is no longer $14. Now it's $20. And when did that happen? You know, it's
right.
Like,
and it doesn't come with fries anymore. I saw somebody commenting on Facebook. It's like a trip to the Bex Prime drive-thru for one is $25 now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and a drink is more than $20. And you know, what they never used to do before that they do now is they flash that screen at you and they want to get tipped on top of that.
Yes. Okay. That's another entirely, you know, long discussion about tipping culture. And again, let's talk about how technology has changed that, right? I mean, the technological advances to be able to just flip that screen around right in your face when you got all these people standing behind you in line watching which button you're going to push. I mean, that has completely changed. And that is technology driven. And, you know, now that is changing the labor model for restaurants. So when we talk about people opening new concepts and thinking about how they're going to run things, that technology has changed how restaurateurs will think about their labor model for new concepts, because they can supplement labor costs by getting people to tip on things that they ordinarily wouldn't have been tipping on.
Right, right, right. Before they would have had to pay that counter person $12 an hour. Now they can pay the minimum wage, knowing that they're going to get a tip on top of it that'll make up the difference.
Yeah, hopefully. even $9, you know, even 9 or 10 makes a difference in the restaurant's bottom line. You know, when you're working on a 3 to 4 to 5% margin to begin with, those pennies add up at the end of the year, and it makes a huge difference on survivability. And you know, we talk about, unfortunately, some of the closures, you know, and I have seen personally the increase in inquiries about people selling and people reaching out, you know, how do I get out from under this lease, or can you help me find somebody to take this over and all of that. I just read some article that somebody posted within the past couple of days about 20 new openings that are coming to Houston in the near future, you know.
Well, right. And I want to talk to you about that, but just take a half a step back, because like, you know, we saw like sometimes that works out, right? Like, as you mentioned, Diane and Willett sold most of Burger Chan to a new operator who's going to take that concept and grow it. And they were able to do that because Burger Chan has been so successful. I wonder if you're struggling, like why would a buyer potentially be interested in, I don't want to name names, but you know, but in a concept that's not doing as well, where the owners want out, because if you were interested in the real estate, like you could just let it close and then swoop in, you know, or you know, like I was on CityCast last week and Raheel Ramzanali asked me, like, do you like Picos has had all this, not to pick on Picos, but Picos has had this huge surge in business since they were announcing the closing. Does that make it more likely that maybe someone would want to come in and keep Picos going? You know, like what are the circumstances under which like someone, a new party would be interested in taking over a restaurant in your experience?
Right. So when you look at something like that, when somebody has an ongoing business that they want to leave for whatever reason, there's two ways you can go about it. You can put it on the market as a going concern And typically, in order to be a going concern, you've got to be profitable in some form or fashion. The more profitable, the better asking price you can get, the more likely it is that somebody's going to want to come in and take it over. And, you know, then you look at the lease and how much time is left and all of those other considerations. But the flip side is when it is not profitable. And then you're basically looking at an asset sale. And that is, what does the FF&E look like, the furniture, fixtures, and equipment? You know, what physical value is there to any of that stuff? Because when you value any business, right, not just a restaurant, if it's losing money, it's very difficult to get people to want to come in and take it over as an ongoing concern. And so those are the two categories, right? You get the going concern and you get the asset sale. And, you know, truthfully, right now, the inquiries that we're getting, there's both. There are some that are doing better than others. And, you know, there are some that people are just like, if I can get enough money to pay off my loan, you know, it'd be great and I can get out of this. And some recognize, you know, that it's almost, they're not giving it away, but they need to do something else and they want to move on.
Well, and that's probably what happened with Candente taking over where Mandito's was in Bel Air, right? Like they decided that concept wasn't viable at that location. And then they looked for someone to come in and take over the lease and the assets and get something. And for the Candente folks, it was like, this is a great neighborhood. We can't wait to be part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's always value in second generation places, you know, whether you look at it sort of as theoretical or physical, right? You know, there's a bunch of equipment that you don't have to go buy. Maybe there's tables and chairs that you can reuse, et cetera. You don't have to build out the bathrooms and the plumbing and the new
the vent hood and all the other
the vent hood, which is super expensive, the grease trap, which is super expensive. So if you can make use of that, it's great. If you can get into something more cheaply, it's not always the case that a second gen space is going to be, you know, absolutely the end all be all, and it's going to be super cheap. But in theory, it's going to be cheaper. And a lot of folks, when they're coming into this, can say, look, if I can avoid going and taking a bank loan or going to the SBA, for example, or raising a bunch of money through friends and family, I'm going to be more likely to survive if there's going to be some downturns, right? If there's going to be some rough spots. One of the things that I've always said is I get asked a lot, why do so many restaurants fail? And it's not necessarily because it's obviously not just one thing most often, but it's not just about having good food or good service or a good location. One of the biggest reasons, in my opinion, in my experience, that places don't make it is they're undercapitalized. They just don't realize how expensive it is to get something open and to then operate it and to withstand some challenges. And God knows we've had challenges in this town, you know, whether it's a freeze or a flood or, you know, whatever it might be.
Right. We all learned the word derecho last year. I mean,
God, yeah. I know. I mean, just enough already. But inevitably, those things happen. And if folks don't have enough in the rainy day fund and they're not capitalized enough on the front end, they're much less likely to be able to make it. And if you start out behind the eight ball, it's really, really hard to get out from under that. And I look at, you know, I mentioned your article about the 20 new locations that are opening. When you think about that from an operational standpoint, if you take a step back and you think about those 20 concepts that are coming soon, those were planned 18 months ago, 12 months ago, right? Somebody just didn't decide yesterday that this is going to open in the next month or two. So those things have been in the works for a while. And that was before some of the economic, you know, uncertainty that we've experienced this year. Now, those projects are going forward. My hope is, again, that they will be well-capitalized and have, you know, understand the challenges that they're stepping into right now. But it's different. The market and the industry today, when they're getting ready to open in the next, let's say, 3 to 6 months, is a heck of a lot different than maybe when they started planning that concept 12, 18 months ago. It's a whole different universe.
Well, and I mean, the other thing is, you know, that list, you know, I do these lists from time to time. And sometimes I can find 30 or even 40 places.
And sure, and because there's so many that we don't even know about, right? I mean, well, there's a bunch more that we don't even know about.
Right. But like this year, it's, you know, 20 is a relatively small number. And I realized afterwards I missed a couple places. It really should have been, you know, 22 or 23 even. But it's not that, like, the pace is slowed. And even compared to the beginning of this year, when it felt like every couple of weeks we had, you know, Latuli or Perseid or Chardon or Agnes and Sherman or Camaraderie. It just, like, it was like a very steady progression in the beginning of the year. And then at the end of the year, it's like,
yeah,
it's a lot thinner.
Well, and think about those concepts that you just listed, those four that you just listed, those are all large, relatively expensive, right? Those are not little 1500 square foot grab and go, you know, fast casual places. Those are big. So I guarantee you those have been in the works since the end of, let's say, 2023. They're probably early 24. Those have been in the works since then. And think about how different the economic outlook was at the end of 2023 than it is today.
Well, and even thinking about, like, a couple of the things that are coming this fall that were in that list, you know, you look at Doc's Jazz Club or 1111 or Hipsy, it's like Hipsy's going into a hotel, right? The hotel has to have a restaurant. They can subsidize the cost of operating the restaurant as an amenity for hotel guests, right? They have to have something on that property to feed people.
Yeah.
And then similarly, like, you know, that Tower Theater complex, that's Radom Capital, right? They're investing a ton of money into that. They know from their experience at everything from Heights Mercantile to MKT to all the other projects they've done, Montrose Collective, those developments do better with some food in them. So, you know, they signed Nando's and they're doing Docs and they're doing 1111 because it makes it more appealing to their other tenants, right? It lets them lease the rest of the project more easily.
Yes. The challenge there always is, how do I say this diplomatically, but you hope that the landowners and the developers that have those types of developments understand the difficulty that a lot of restaurants have with the level of rent that they need to command in order to make those developments work economically for them, for the developers, because those things are just hundreds of millions of dollars to develop. They've got to recoup that because they have investors, they have banks, they, you know, you name it.
Right. Everybody's got someone, right? Like, you know.
It's tough. And it definitely makes it more challenging on restaurants. But I will say again, and I always come back to, Houston is such a great place to be in the business. It's so much better than to be doing it, in my opinion, than other places around the country economically. I don't think we're going to see a slowdown of folks that want to be in Houston. The question is, how do we support it and how do they set themselves up for success? Think about, for example, the chefs that we know who used to be from Houston, who are coming back, who want to be in Houston, right? We got Dom Lee is back. Ryan Hildebrand is coming back. Richard Knight is coming back. Evan Turner's back. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who went off to other places from Houston who have decided that they want to come back to Houston. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know,
and we still have interest from national groups. I mean, on the Tuesday show, I talked about Local Public Eatery that's coming here from, you know, just opened in the Woodlands from Canada. You know, Fox Restaurants, the group behind Flower Child and North, is doing the Henry on Post Oak. I think some of that has slowed down a little bit. But I do think, like, we still see, you know, that there's interest from some of these bigger national operators in Houston.
Yeah, and our population growth hasn't really slowed that much. I mean, you know, Houston is still continuing to grow, and there are still, you know, areas that are underserved. So I think we're still going to see that growth. I think you're definitely going to see folks coming in from other parts of Texas and or other areas of the country who are really going to be looking for those second gen spaces that, you know, they're going to say, okay, well, we're seeing some heightened turnover. Here's an opportunity for us to get in to a really great market relatively speaking, you know, from the other places around the country. Let's try to get in there and take over some of these second gen spaces. So we'll see.
Right. You mentioned, you know, find an area where you can dominate the neighborhood. You know, where are you seeing the most growth? I mean, we keep talking about Memorial and Spring Branch over the last like year or two. That's been a very popular destination for people who maybe don't, you know, could have been like, they probably would have been in Montrose or the Heights 5 years ago, but now they're going to Memorial and Spring Branch. You know, obviously I just mentioned Candente and Bel Air. I think it feels like there's quite a bit of opportunity in the kind of Bel Air, Meyerland, Western Edge of West U kind of situation. And then, you know, like I have this conversation, you know, you see it all the time. There's a concert at Smart Financial Center. Where do I go in Sugarland?
Right.
Like, what's the best restaurant in Sugarland? Like I, you know, it can't be Japanero's. Like I refuse to believe that it's Japanero's, but I'm worried that it is. And I wonder why, like where are the smart, independently owned, like restaurants in Sugarland that aren't, you know, like for some immigrant community or another, right? That have a kind of a more of a mass appeal.
Well, when you start talking about, you know, Sugarland specifically, and you can wrap the Woodlands or something, you know, and to some extent Katy into that. I mean, those are truly the burbs, and the demographics are different. The family aspect of dining is very different. So I think, you know, that's a very simplistic answer to a likely, you know, a lot more complicated question. But, you know, those great, smart, independent restaurant operators are in Montrose, in the Heights, and they're going to Spring Branch. They're going to the east side of downtown. Bel Air is tougher to me. And we spend, you know, a fair amount of time in Bel Air. We're close. It's very dense. There's not necessarily a whole lot of space available. A lot of the spaces are older, they're smaller, et cetera. So you don't necessarily see a lot of turnover. And so while it's very dense, it's very kind of small and neighborhood oriented. I think that's why you see, for example, a place like Blood Brothers, you know, that's very, very small, but it kills right there. You know, it does really, really well because it's where else do you go in that area for really cool, you know, barbecue and call it fusion. I don't know what you really want to call it, but Asian fusion barbecue. There's nothing like it, and it dominates that neighborhood. So yeah, Bel Air is a little trickier, but if you're thinking about what comes next, where are people going next? Spring Branch, I definitely see a whole lot of opportunity. There's a lot of gentrification over there. There's a ton of rooftops. You know, things are being redeveloped. That whole kind of energy corridor, Beltway, I-10 area, I think has a lot of opportunity. And then you're going to see, you know, kind of going east from downtown, right? East River being developed, that navigation corridor. Because you see, you had Jonathan's the Rub over there.
Yeah, which by all accounts, Star. Like I was really nervous for Jonathan's the Rub because two other places had bounced in and out of there pretty fast. And by all accounts, my understanding is it's doing very well.
Yeah, they're in that same strip with Roostar, which correct. I know is doing well.
Right across the street from El Tiempo and Neen Fizz.
Exactly. So yeah, so you're getting some density there. You're having you know, that pocket, and that's only going to expand. And particularly as you see more residential being built over there, you know, that infrastructure is coming in. It you know, could be another 10, 15 years, but that's, it's proximity to downtown, you know, all of that.
Well, right. But right. But if you're looking at a lease in East River, you don't have 10 or 15 years. Like Midway does. Like Midway's still going to own that property 100 years right. from now. Like they don't care. But,
no.
But if you're, you know, like I haven't talked to the guys at City Sellers, to hear what their experience has been like, because they're leading the charge there. Right. Like
I've talked to Daniel a lot in the past few weeks, and, you know, they're doing well. I mean, truthfully, they are doing well. They are kind of on an island right now, unfortunately. You know, it's the old adage in the industry, right? Nobody wants to be first. And somebody's got to be first, but nobody wants to be first. And so, you know, they are by all accounts, they are doing quite well, considering the fact that there's not a lot of residential that's up yet. The office buildings aren't occupied, et cetera. But you've got the Astorian folks over there with their second location up on the rooftop, the big, beautiful event venue that's up there. So those two are really the only ones. That doesn't necessarily feed into City Sellers. So that right now it's a destination, and it's tough to be first. It's tough to be a destination. By all accounts, they are weathering that fairly well. And I think as East River further develops and you see more development in that area on that navigation corridor, I think it's only going to get better and better for them. But you just got to be able to survive. And again, that's kind of why I come back kind of full circle to you got to be well capitalized. You got to be able to survive until things, either turn around for whatever reason or build up around you if you're kind of a first mover.
Yeah. Or that, dominate the neighborhood, right? Like yes. Bar Bluedorn going into that Jonathan Serup Space and Memorial, they can dominate the neighborhood. Latuli can dominate the neighborhood.
Yeah. It's, and those are obviously well thought out, well planned, openings, and those guys absolutely know what they're doing, right? They're serious industry vets and they know how to create that type of concept to be able to fit into that neighborhood and all immediately, like Bar Bluedorn's a great example, immediately day one, be super popular with the neighborhood, right? I mean, it was like a no-brainer.
Almost to the folks where people are like grateful that it's there. Like,
yeah, they didn't know they needed it, right?
Right.
It just happened. And I'm sure there was a lot of thought and research that went into that before that became a thing. So it's an interesting time. It's very challenging, but again, it's nice to be in Houston. And I think the community, frankly, the hospitality community in Houston is phenomenal. And I think that really helps to make people understand what it takes and to support locally, et cetera. We've got a phenomenal restaurant community here. It's fun to be a part of it, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I've now been a part of it for 13 years, and it's been a lot of fun to be a part of. I guess we're running long, so I don't want to drag this out for too much longer, but because I think you're right. I think we have not seen the last of the closings. I think there's going to be, something that hurts, like some historic restaurant that's been around, like Pico's, it's been around for 30, 40, 50 years, that's going to close sometime between now and the end of the year, and we're all going to fall to pieces about what a tragedy it is, and we're not going to ask the obvious question, which is, when is the last time you ate there,
right?
Like what were you doing to help support this place that you have fond memories of going to with your grandparents? But at the same time, I'm not I'm concerned for specific restaurants, but I'm not really concerned for the restaurant industry, because I think ultimately, like, we're still a dining out culture, and we still, like, there's and a lot, as you said, like, a lot of smart people are investing a lot of money to open these new places. And so if they're feeling optimistic, then
yeah,
I'm not going to be pessimistic.
It's as we talked about earlier, it is a process of adaptation. There is adaptation on the industry side, which has been literally flipped on its head in the past 5 years. And there is adaptation on the consumer side. And all of this is happening in real time. We're kind of witnessing as it happens. And yeah, there's always going to be closures that everybody laments, right? And nobody wants to see a grand dame close for whatever reason it is. And maybe just somebody reaches that point in their life where, like, I'm tired and I want to retire and that's enough and we're done. And that's totally fine. And those things are going to happen. But you're right. The industry and the consumers will survive, but it's changed. And I think we're still, and speaking now as just a consumer, right? Not as part of the industry, but as a consumer, everybody's still adapting, and the adaptation phase has not ended. So I think it's still a work in progress. We could have this conversation 18 months from now, and it's going to be completely different. And we'll see. We'll see how we've changed. We'll see what's new and what's gone, and we'll take stock at that point and see what the future looks like. But I still say it's better to be here in Houston than it is most any other place around the country.
All right. Well, I'm going to say that's a good place to wrap this up. Jonathan Horowitz, how can people stay in touch or keep track of what you're doing? Or, you know, you're not in quite the same public facing role that you've been in your previous times on this podcast.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, social media is great. I'm out there on Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, and then Convive Hospitality Consulting, and then Restaurant Realty Group on the real estate side. So, you know, it's not hard to find me if somebody really wants to.
Jonathan Horowitz, thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric. Always a pleasure.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. This is your periodic reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, etc. As always, you are welcome. I always appreciate your comments. You can DM me on Instagram. You can email me, eric@culturemap.com. If you like this podcast, tell a friend, rate us. But like Katie Nolan used to say, only if it's 5 stars and only if it's nice. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.